Happy Halloween, everybody. It's October 31st, 2008. This is 508, a show about Worcester. Good morning, guys. This is Mike Benedetti. I've lost my voice. We have no special guests this week, which I guess works out well because I don't have to question them. But we do have some regular panelists, Bruce Russell, the Snow Ghost, and Brendan Mellican. How are you guys doing?
Excellent. Thanks, Mike.
I'm good.
Awesome. Bruce, I'm glad to hear it. Well, you know, Bruce, we have a good interview with your friend Scott Schaefer Duffy later on the show today about a court hearing he has next week. Also, Ken Hanford-Riccardi will be at that hearing with him. I have one really positive thing to talk about, but I bet you guys have some positive or negative things to talk about, too. So what's in your minds this morning?
Well, now that we covered that. Yeah, you know, the only thing that I think is worth talking about this week, although it's been talked to death to some degree already, is the seemingly inevitable knife ban that we're going to have in Worcester. And I think the thing that's most interesting about it now, from my perspective, is that I remember one of the 508 podcasts probably 6 months ago that you, Jeff, and myself, we pretty much predicted, half jokingly, I think, that this is where we would end up at some point in time. It was I don't remember which podcast it was, but it was one we did at Stone Soup. I think in the same episode, we also almost convinced Annie Leuenberg to trash talk the Worcester Public Schools and break character. So, but yeah, it's kind of crazy that something that we were joking about as being like a potential is now really the best that the Worcester City Council could come up with in terms of a solution to a problem we're not even sure we have yet.
I'm kind of surprised that this is happening. You know, I grew up mostly in West Virginia and Oklahoma, and I can just imagine what would happen to a politician trying to do a knife ban in some of those cities. It's like trying to do a shoe ban, you know, which is, I guess, what they kind of do at the airport, or at least a shoe inspection. So
yeah,
you can't.
It's really weird, and it, you know, that when it gets kind of scary is, I think you can find it on Radio Ball, and it's obviously on the WCCA website, but. Yeah, there's an interview with Councillor Petty, who, you know, is the one who put this this ordinance in front of the council. It's being supported unanimously by the council, so I guess they all take credit for it. But he's the one that threw it out there, and it's really the interview with Morrow. It's kind of, to me, troubling because he doesn't really seem to have any idea what he's talking about. It's the sort of, you know, it's the sort of fluff stuff that you throw out at people just to make them feel better. But he doesn't really seem to have any real concrete sort of ideas about what this ordinance is supposed to do and even what it's in response to. You know, and I think the same could be said for our district attorney, you know, Joe Early Jr., when he was speaking before the city council this week, didn't have a lot of absolute, wasn't dealing in absolutes, right? I mean, he wasn't saying this is exactly what we're dealing with and this is exactly what we intend to do about it. They've drawn up this ordinance, which essentially gives, it's just going to give police discretionary power that they already have. You know, so, and that's a sort of slippery slope for normal people because it assumes that all future administrations are going to have the same overall worldview that the current administration has. So, I mean, as it stands, or very shortly, knives over an inch and a half in Worcester will be flatly illegal. You cannot have them. As it stands today,
you could have them in your house, couldn't you?
Yeah, you're just not going to be able to have them, you know, out in public. But when the ordinance, you know, out of the gate, the idea is we're not going to be rounding people up, but I'll still be able to carry my pocket knife, and I'm not going to end up in the hoosegow. It's going to be if I get arrested for something else, that will be, you know, an additional charge. It'll be discretionary powers for the police. But to assume that that's always going to be the case, that's naive. I mean, I think it's very naive to just assume that the next chief of police or 10 chiefs of police from now are going to have the same worldview, that they're not going to just turn around and make that an absolute. We are banning them effectively soon as this ordinance is out of the gate.
It seems like they're saying we can't write an ordinance. We're not smart enough to write an ordinance, or we don't have the time to write an ordinance that actually does what we want it to do. So we're going to write an ordinance that doesn't do what we want it to do, and then we're going to say, but, you know, we all know what it's supposed to do. We're all going to, you know, behave in the right way. which doesn't seem like it's like the point of writing a law.
No.
You're not supposed to leave it to most of the interpretation, are you?
No. I mean, well, that's the whole, we always have, we have a discretionary component to, you know, law enforcement. There's no doubt about that. But it's to be using good judgment. You know, I think someone on Radio Ball used the example of if a cop sees someone speeding down the highway and pulls them over and finds out that they're just speeding being a jerk, that person gets a ticket. But if they find out that they've got a child in the car gushing blood, they give them an escort to the hospital, right? I mean, it's like the same crime is being committed, but you use your discretion.
Yes.
You're not going to give a pregnant lady a ticket for rushing to the hospital.
But that's a situation where 99% of the time, if somebody's speeding,
right,
you want them to get a ticket or a warning or whatever. Whereas, think of how many thousand people are going to walk down the street in Worcester today with a regular sized knife in their pocket.
Yep.
Well, maybe, like, I might probably walk over to my friend's house and bring some good cutlery with me to cook some dinner because I have some nice knives I like. Yep. And, like, there it is. I'm breaking the law. Why do you...
Yep.
Now you've just decided to make me a minor criminal for no reason at all.
And, you know, ultimately, the only problem we have in the city is we have... This sounds... I think it makes it sound more simplistic than it is, because there are tragedies involved here with violence and whatnot. But these are really behavior issues with a small percentage of people in our society, right? I mean, we in Worcester, we really don't have a lot of crime and or violent crime. We just don't. I mean, anyone who's spent any amount of time in a larger city or a city that actually does have a lot of crime, this is not what it looks like. And, you know, we need to be figuring out. We need to reel in the small number of people we have in our society that have, like, serious behavior problems, right? I mean, and that isn't an easy thing to do, and I think that's ultimately the problem. We don't have leadership in this city that's willing to do a lot of hard work, so instead they want to do just a little bit of easy work that's going to make people mostly unaffected by this kind of crime feel better.
You know,
this is the kind of ordinance that makes, you know, soccer moms feel really, really good about themselves, because they don't think their kids should have knives anyways, and they probably didn't have a knife to begin with. That's the kind of person that's going to feel better about this. The person who actually lives in a neighborhood where there is violence on a somewhat regular basis, they're not going to feel any better about this ordinance, because it's going to do absolutely nothing.
Because they got enough trouble that's not knife-related versus that is knife-related. You know, I wanted to ask you, is there no libertarian lobby in this city? You know, I'm thinking we got the group Real Solutions together after the city council did something similar with their misguided anti-panhandling campaign, which ended up as a fiasco. And since then, Real Solutions has been there when people in leadership positions were about to do something kind of thoughtless and dumb. To say, well, hey, don't do this. And in some cases, they've won. And in some cases, like in the vendor case, they've just managed to drag it on for a lot longer and make it a lot more public.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe that there's not... I mean, like, we know there's outraged people about this because you get all these people blogging and whatever, but that doesn't really... That has zero traction.
Right.
You know, I'm just thinking, like, what percentage of people... You know, maybe I don't have a good sense of what Worcester's like. But anyway, is there nobody out there who's like... I don't know, I guess I'm disappointed that there's nobody out there who's got the Worcester Libertarian Club willing to write a sternly worded letter.
Yeah,
about
well,
this.
I think there are two things in play there. One is I think that Libertarian Club should be the ACLU, and I mean I think it's unfortunate that I think it's still Nevada is the only chapter of the ACLU that is willing to take public stances on, you know. Weapons, say, for, like, self-defense and whatnot,
right.
like, pro-Second Amendment stances. And it seems as though every other chapter is unwilling to come out and take a public stance.
This isn't even weapons-related, though. Like, I'm a freaking pacifist, and I don't like this.
Right, but the thing is that I think that's the only real... You don't have any sort of, like, constitutional right to just carry
a knife.
Whatever you want, right? I mean, like, not everything is protected. I think you could make a well-reasoned Second Amendment case for carrying a knife, if you wanted to. I mean, if you wanted to take that route, I think that's where, you know, a civil libertarian group would have most success, would be trying to reason out or flesh out a Second Amendment case. I mean, it's purely logical that people should be able to carry tools. I mean, that's not that we shouldn't need some sort of protection to cover that. But I don't think that you'd find much traction in terms of making that sort of argument in the face of you know, outraged politicians and outraged citizens. The other thing, though, more directly to your question, do we have a libertarian group here? I think libertarians in Massachusetts have kind of burnt themselves out. There was a really strong push in the late 90s. I hung out with a lot of libertarians in the city here. I mean, the first time that Carla Howell ran for office, I think it was against Ted Kennedy at the time. And that, I think that was the year that the Libertarian Party became an official party in the state. And it seemed like it was making some great traction. And then a lot of the leadership in the state got a little crazy. And they don't seem to make a hell of a lot of sense. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of fracture mindsets within the libertarian community in the city and in Massachusetts at large. And I think you've got most civil libertarians just, I don't know, if they talk to themselves or whatnot. Those are the people that are blogging and whatnot and just complaining to nobody because there is no real organization, which is unfortunate. But I think that's where the ACLU is supposed to kind of come into play there.
Well, there is a gap. I have to say, my impression is that the anarchists in this city are better organized than the libertarians. So there you go. I wanted to mention something from the city council meeting that Kevin Kassin forwarded along. From the Committee on Traffic and Parking, request city manager and the Economic Development Office provides city council with overwhelming evidence that provides the Standing Committee on Traffic and Parking substantial facts that economic development would be a net gain and public safety would be held in balance in making Millbury Street a two-way street. I wish that on more issues, the city council demanded overwhelming evidence and substantial facts rather than, you know, however I feel right now. However, the one guy I asked this issue about feels, because that's how it seems like they make a lot of these decisions. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's stop complaining about the city council. Hey, Bruce.
Bruce, what?
It's Halloween.
Yeah?
You're the only one here who's written a Halloween-themed book. I wanted to ask you if you have any thoughts about the holiday.
I haven't really thought about it, though. I just want to comment some of the quotes in the people in the street in the Ocean magazine. One woman says, the only thing that scares me is the people ask her question, and the stranger go off and ask her question. I'm kind of feel that same way myself. There's another woman who kind of said there's a house in Rhode Island, it's Amityville. I'm thinking Amityville horror isn't in Long Island, isn't in Rhode Island. It's Long Island. So
there you go.
I think somebody goofed on that one.
Do you know what, man? That's spooktacular. I'm wondering, do you guys have anything? Did you want to do some quick election predictions before we talk about positive things and talk to Scott Schaefer Duffy?
You want to do predictions or do you want to want to play some bets?
I don't have any money. Bruce, do you have any money to bet?
We can bet good tidings, or I don't know, we can plug each other's crap or something like that.
I want to point out that the first episode of 508 was intentionally named Mayor Gary Rosen. Because we're all about, which didn't end up happening, because we're all about going out on a limb, though.
I will be happy to make a bunch of predictions as far as Election Day is concerned.
What are your election predictions?
Question one is going to fail by a very narrow margin, like an extremely narrow margin, the kind of narrow margin that's going to make a lot of people really, really nervous. Question two is going to, that's the marijuana question, and the most important aspect of this this election cycle, is going to succeed by an overwhelming margin. I think it'll probably succeed. It'll probably be in the high 60 to 70 percentile of
now,
people who...
Let me ask you about that. That seems like if that happens, that'll be a real, a real splash of water in the face to a lot of people.
I think it absolutely will. I think it'll be a bit of a wake-up call. I mean, here's something interesting that came out this week that's a bit of an aside to that idea. You know, it was 2 weeks ago that the president of Mexico started publicly stating that Mexico needs to start working on some decriminalization policies in terms of its war on drugs, which is essentially America's war on drugs via proxy, because of the death toll that they're seeing in Mexico. I mean, the parts of the border regions in Mexico are just being torn to shreds because over the war on drugs. And the United States Drug Czar came out last week to support their marijuana decriminalization efforts. Like that, even just the men came out in favor of their marijuana decriminalization efforts. Now, I don't think that our drugs are is probably thought that out in the sense that, you know, there are American states that are trying to pass the similar sorts of legislation and whatnot. But in essence, the U.S. drug czar is in favor of the same sort of decriminalization or path to decriminalization that we are partaking in here in Massachusetts, just as long as it's in another country, which says a lot. You know, I mean, it's just a mixing of terms and whatnot. And but I think pretty much everybody is in favor of this policy, except for Rosalie Torelli, which we know from this week's
also Billy Breaux.
And Billy Breaux.
Everyone else sound funny about that?
Oh, what is that, Bruce?
Well, it's not really, it's not funny, is it? But I mean, of all the cities and places in the country I've gone, this is like the only city that I've ever had people ask, are you looking for something? I always thought when I first got here, I thought, yeah, man, I like women, what's your problem?
Were they asking you, was it somebody soliciting you as a prostitute or trying to sell you drugs?
No, they said, you straight? I said, yeah, I'm straight. They said, yeah, I like women.
Oh, you mean like they were trying to figure out if you were trying to buy drugs?
Yeah.
Man, I have to say, very few people have tried to sell me drugs in the city. I don't know. I must come off as no fun. I don't know what's going on. I wanted to read a great line from this Rosalie Torella op-ed. Marijuana decriminalization would embolden the punks and pukes of the neighborhood. I told that line to somebody, a local artist, and he immediately got really excited and wrote down the phrase "embolden the punks." there may be a shirt coming out of this.
That seems like exactly the sort of thing we need more of in Worcester. We need to go back to our roots and start re-emboldening the punks. Yeah. So thank you for the advice, Rosalind. Question three, I think will also pass, but I think it's going to pass by a much more narrow margin than its supporters will be happy with. Uh-huh. I talking to, you know, coworkers and random acquaintances and whatnot about question three, people don't seem to the big component of that about the state subsidizing the tracks and dog racing, that component seems to not necessarily have made it into the heads of a lot of people who are going to be voting on Tuesday.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. I've really not seen that anywhere. I would think that would be sort of the second part of the 1-2 punch on that. I understand people have a focused message.
You know, when I explain that to people the way it was explained to us here on the show, people seem to get it. I'm like, okay, well, I can see why we don't necessarily need something that is essentially supported by the state. But yeah, it doesn't seem like that component of the message hit home. So I think it'll pass, but I think it's going to pass by a narrow margin. And when that happens, one of the problems is, you know, even though these are binding ballot questions, the legislature can still alter them. So I think it'll be interesting to see what actually happens with dog racing once the legislature gets its hands on it moving into next year.
Do you think they're going to screw up question two?
I think that's going to pass by such an overwhelming percentage that they won't really have much room to move on it. But I wouldn't be surprised if language is altered. I mean, the question as it's written is not written by the legislature. And you know, I mean, that's just a territorial thing. In all likelihood, they are going to reword it to suit their needs, even if they don't think they're changing that much, just changing the language so it fits into the MGL the way that they want it to. I think there are going to be alterations made. And I don't know where those alterations are going to be, but I could definitely foresee, quantities changing. You know, right now the ounce seems to be the magic number in Weedville for what we're going to make the cutoff point. I don't know that that's going to see its way to paper. There's a lot of room for things to be altered before we find ourselves just with our $100 fine. I don't know. Beyond the questions, the hard part with making predictions for elections is we don't know where people are actually listening. And throughout the city, we've got a bunch of different races in play.
I actually have no idea who I'm going to be voting for because I don't know who will be on my ballot because I'm not sure what district I live in.
I guess the only two races that are contested right now in terms of state reps for Worcester are going to be the Splane Mahoney race, and that's
that's a sticker.
John Mahoney, who is the write-in candidate against Bob Splane. I think that I don't think there's any question that Bob is going to win his re-election. And I think there was a lot of terrible, terrible, you know, political strategy in play on the Mahoney side of things, where not only is he going to lose, but now he's going to end up losing against a candidate that had a lot of dirt thrown at him over the last couple weeks. And I think that's going to make John Mahoney look any even weaker when it comes to running for future office, whether that be a council seat again, or like he did, you know, a year and a half ago, or, you know, a state rep or state senate seat. So I think that is actually going to blow up in his face, you know, running a sticker campaign as a relative unknown in the final 2 weeks of an election. The other state rep seat there that's contested is John Frisolo, and has a Matt Taylor running against him, another relative unknown who's running as an independent. I think the Telegram actually had a write-up today. To be honest with you, before today, I hadn't heard Matt Taylor's name mentioned since he announced that he was running against John Frisolo, you know, back in the spring. So I think that's kind of interesting, and because this guy has done so little work in getting his name out there, I think he's going to get completely crushed in terms of his campaign against the state rep Frisolo. And state senate seats, you've got, I can't even remember the guy whose name was running against Mike Moore. I didn't realize that there was somebody running against the Democrats in the state senate seat that's been freed up by Ed Augustus. So I don't even know how to name drop the guy who's running against Mike Moore.
And name recognition is really important on a lot of these.
What was that, Mike?
Name recognition is really important on a lot of these.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, though, too. Like, I can't imagine that I'm the only person who has no idea what this guy's name is. And that probably says a lot for Mike Moore. Bruce. And then you've got the presidential election there. And, you know, this is actually scaring the hell out of me. Depending on if you talk to a Republican or you talk to a Democrat, everyone thinks it's in the tank for their guy. And that kind of election really scares the heck out of me. I'm supposed to be getting on a plane Wednesday morning at about 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'm still not totally convinced that I'm going to be able to fly on Wednesday morning. Like, I think it's going to be a lot of really, really angry people, at least the potential for a lot of really angry people. 50% of the country being really angry Wednesday morning. It's going to be an interesting thing.
There's a lot of people already in the country already angry, so Wednesday morning has nothing to do with it, really.
Well, it has to do with their anger being reinforced, I guess.
Bruce, are you going to vote on Tuesday?
I don't know where I'm going.
You don't know. You're an undecided voter. You're not even sure if you're like... You're such an undecided voter, you don't even know if you're a likely voter. Good for you, man.
All right.
Bruce, I want to ask you, is there anything exciting going on in the city this week? Or anything going on recently?
No, yesterday and the day before, there's a strange guy yesterday that said to me, I said, I see you on the show, see you on the cable access. And there's a woman that used to live over on Holly Street. Remember that? I don't know if you remember that boarded up house that was where the paint was falling off one time.
Yeah.
She saw me the other day on a bike and said, I see you all the time on cable.
You know what, man? Actually, that's kind of what I want to talk about for our positive thing of the week. Is that, you know, we just put up a Snow Ghost episode about the Mystery Band Project. This is kind of a late summer project among a certain demographic in the city. Actually, a number of demographics to just throw people together into bands just for the experience of people writing some songs with semi-strangers and then doing a big show. And I was watching the tape of it, and I just remembered what a great experience it was. You know, it's just like, it's the epitome of making your own fun. You know, it's making your own fun and then getting the kind of fun out of it you could never get another way. You know, I just had a great time doing that. And I was just so glad that, the show gave me this excuse to, like, tape this thing. So 5 years from now, I can sit down and look at it and say, man, that was a good time. It makes me happy about the city when I watch that tape. You know, there's at least 100 people in the city who are just totally awesome, and they're all... a lot of them are on that tape. Brendan, what's on your mind this week for the city?
I don't have a lot of real local, nothing that's locally focused this week. I'm just really pumped. I love elections. This is like my favorite time of the year. So I'm really just excited on, sort of a global level watching the last few days of this election cycle wrap up. This is like Christmas for me. This is kind of like this is really what gets me worked up. So
Christmas, you know, in November, as they say.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, we're gonna have an interview now with Scott Schaefer Duffy. But thanks for being on the show.
I gotta go. Okay, I'm gonna head out. So I guess.
All right, man.
So.
All right, and all of our listeners, thank you so much. This is Mike Benedetti. I'm here with Scott Schaefer Duffy. Scott, in September, you were found guilty of disobeying the orders of a federal marshal for your Lenten prayer against the Iraq War that you did at the federal building, and you and your other four co-defendants were all asked to pay the minimum fine of like $250. And three of the co-defendants, including myself, said sure. And you and Ken Hanford-Ricardi said no. And so next week on November 6th at 10 a.m., you guys go back before Judge Hillman to find out what happens. And I wanted to ask you why you declined to pay the fine and what you think is going to happen on the 6th.
Well, I think Ken and I both agreed that despite the verdict of the judge, and without any undue personal disrespect to the judge, we still believe what we did was right.
Okay.
And we also believe in both of our instances we have low income, and in my instance that income is donated for predominantly
Catholic
for our work,
workers.
The Catholic worker, right. And it would be an inconsistency in our fundraising for me to use that to divert it to the federal government, which is doing so many things that we disagree with.
Uh-huh.
And it would also be a bit of acquiescence to the court. I've always felt that the court can punish me for what I've done wrong, for what they say is I've done wrong. But if I believe I'm doing what's right, I'm not going to punish myself.
Okay.
And so this, the other thing too is I think this judge had a certain amount of sympathy, but he wasn't quite willing to, you know, to really stand out against the
right.
war.
But it's true that he did say, "I'm going to give everyone the bare minimum."
Right, right. He showed a fair amount of sympathy, but having people, you know, the five of us pay, it was $280,
including costs. Right,
right. Right. But having the five of us pay $1,000, you know, more than $1,000, mm-hmm. you know, with almost $1,300 for praying the rosary against the Iraq War and exercising our right to express our view in court is a bit outrageous. It's actually one of the largest fines I've ever been assessed.
Okay.
I've been assessed 50 and 100 and so on. And some people, $280 is not much money, but it's a fair amount of money for us.
Yeah.
And this puts the judge this in, you know, and as I said to him at the court, I said, this is still a moment for you. You know, and we've seen other judges respond to this different ways. There was a judge that was recommended by the prosecution 6 months in jail and a $2,000 fine, which was the maximum. And the judge asked us what we would be willing to do, and we said nothing. Mm-hmm. And the judge took a recess and came back and let us go with nothing. And this judge, you know, made a decision. He found it difficult. He went, you know, he breathed out.
Right.
And so I did mention that, plus another judge that actually donated $10 to the Catholic worker for each of myself and a co-defendant. He said, well, that's not likely to happen.
Right, right.
And but I wanted him to realize, look, you know, you have guidelines. You don't have orders on how he needs to sentence people. He has guidelines.
Right.
And he has to use reason and understanding on the basis of our brief and our testimony.
He can't say my hands are tied.
That's right. And in a certain sense, Tom Lucio always used to say, by refusing the fine, you take people off the hook. Because in our society, particularly in the wealthy white society, the unpleasantness of jail and of taking a stand is set aside by an exchange of money.
Mm-hmm.
People do civil disobedience. I was with 500 people who were arrested at the Capitol Rotunda. They all go into jail. They're all in solidarity with King and Gandhi. And then the court says, everybody will release for $50, and everybody rushes to pull out their wallets.
Right.
And in an hour, there's seven of us of the 500 still in custody because we say, well, this is not civil disobedience, it's theater. We're not paying any money. Mm-hmm. We stand, you know, we believe what we do.
Although, I should point out, whenever you and I were arrested on Darfur stuff a couple years ago, we paid $50 and we got out of there.
And now, in that instance, first of all, it wasn't a fine. So it wasn't to the federal government.
Right.
In this instance, this is directly to the federal government. Not the court costs, but the fine is. But also in that instance, we still had a case pending on Darfur. We were in appeals.
Not everybody, but some of you.
Not everybody feels they, you know, in conscience that they cannot pay a fine. And the three of the co-defendants, yourself included, did pay the fine.
Right.
You know, so it's not an obligatory
thing. I'm paying federal taxes this year.
I paid federal taxes years ago.
So I'm just thinking, like, this is not a year when I feel like I can say,
well,
I don't want to pay them $250 because I don't like to pay money, but not. I can't say I'm taking an ethical stand in other areas, so I feel
Right. And we're not, frankly, we're not resisting federal taxes. We're below the taxable income,
so it's
a moot point
for
us on the federal taxes. But you said the right thing, you know, said at this moment, and I think that's important for people to realize. You know, people should do what they can cheerfully and joyfully do. If Claire's mother had another heart attack and so on, and you know, and for me to take the stand at this point would make life extremely difficult for her. You know, I'd have to rethink that. You know, you got to think about what you can do. And I have seen some people overextend themselves. There was a young woman that refused to pay a fine, and more or less had a breakdown in jail. She was just really not a clock student many years ago.
Yeah.
She was really not prepared to this.
Yeah.
And I think some people that were more rigid peace ideologues said this is the only way to go. You know, and they kind of pressured her. And so she did it, and it really wasn't what she should do. So, you know, but anyway, it'll be interesting to see what the judge does. It'll be another chance to, you know, address this issue before the judge. And we're hopeful that he has a, you know, perhaps an apotheosis. And, you know, we won't go to jail. But if we do, it's an opportunity for us to continue witnessing against this war in the jail and through the sacrifice of that experience.
So, like, I'm just trying to think of what the options, his options are, kind of practically. He could send you to jail for a while.
He could do that.
He could. What if he fines you again?
He will offer the fine again. That will be his initial thing. Say, will you pay
and
this
then
fine?
You'll say no, and then he'll say, okay, well, in that case.
And now he has a wide variety of options, and these are just the ones that come to the top of my head. He can send us to jail. He can increase the fine and send us to jail and leave the fine still standing. He can hold us in contempt of court and send us to jail and bring us back periodically and see if we pay the fine.
Okay.
That's probably the most extreme thing.
He's not going to do that. He probably is not going to do that because that ends up making him
into a, you know, kind of a tyrannical person.
He just becomes a news figure. It gets him in the news to do that.
He can also, something that perhaps is more likely, Ken doesn't believe it's likely, is he can sentence us all to a rather stiff jail sentence and then suspend some or all of it on the basis of some probationary penalty of not being arrested again in the federal building.
Right.
And that's something that's imposed. And he may not be creative enough to realize this, if he doesn't make it an imposition, but makes it something that we have to agree to, we will be at another moral quandary.
Because, agreeing with the court.
Yes, because then he'll say, well, you have to, we will suspend the sentence if you promise not to break the law again for a year. And he says, well, Your Honor, we can't make that promise.
Well, especially now that we know that you can get a permit to hold public events, supposedly in the federal building.
Right.
We'll certainly be playing a barbecue or something.
Yeah.
Maybe
so anyway, that, you know, he can do that. He can, there's various community services, creative sentences. I've seen federal judges do all kinds of things. I mean, he can just let there be a guilty finding with no sentence whatsoever. It's entirely, really, up to him. And he is not obligated. I mean, there are guidelines on felonies, and some of them are more firm than others. But this is an infraction. This is a very, very small charge.
This is a petty offense.
Yes, it's a very small charge. And frankly, if he does send us, as Ken believes, to 30 days in jail or longer, it's a very extreme sentence. It's an extreme sentence. And
we should point out in passing that Ken is probably wrong.
Right, true. But in lieu of a $280 fine to send us to jail, which costs more than $100 a day to the taxpayer, is a little bit unusual. But, I mean, I had one judge that was recommended by the prosecutor to give us 60 days, and the prosecutor scolded the judge scolded the prosecutor. Haven't you been listening to these defendants? And sentenced us to a three-day sentence, and it was late in the day, and said, I want the sentence to count today, and I want it to count the day that they release, and I want them released at 7 in the morning. So effectively, it was
he gave you a day.
Yeah, a day. 40 something hours.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's really a wide range. But a lot of less imaginative and, let's say, a little bit fearful judges will give a very familiar speech. My hands are tied. You've left me no choice. They all but asked the bowl of water to be brought out to wash their hands. You've put yourselves in jail. This is not on me. And then they, whatever
don't
they do.
Don't bring up Pontius Pilate. Oh.
No.
Also, don't bring up the
Not
Nazis.
A good idea. No, but a lot of judges will say that. You've put yourself in jail. And this is a speech they're giving to themselves.
Right.
They're not really talking to us at this point because we've already made it clear why we've done what we've done. It's no desire to go to jail. We've both made it abundantly clear. Right. We prefer
yes,
being out
you mentioned
of jail.
This other trial. Like, yes. The best thing would be for you to give us no fine and donate some money.
This is not a bunch of, you know, flaming, desirous martyrs. Regardless of how it may look, stubborn ideologues. But anyway, so we shall see. And I'm always a little more optimistic, and Ken is, of course, he's the barometer for pessimism. So we don't know. And
I tell you, I hope that you get a light consequences, and I hope that if it's heavy consequences, they end up being constructive. You know,
that's true. And the other thing too is, I mean, should it be? You were absolutely right when you said before. If there's anything draconian, or even mildly extreme, even for some people, even in any jail, will seem very severe. It raises the barometer of attention towards how dedicated the state is to defending this war.
Yeah.
And how absurd the lines that it draws are. The area where we wanted to congregate in that building, had we not told them and just gone in and done what we did, had we not written them a letter, given them the courtesy and written a letter, I have almost no doubt we would have been able to do everything we wanted to do.
Because they wouldn't have been able to have enough staff there. They wouldn't have been ready to even deal with it.
I don't think it would have raised their eyebrows. They might have come up, what are you doing? We're praying the rosary quietly. Oh, okay.
And they would have made some calls back to the home office,
but
and by the time they figured something out,
someone along
the
line, because of the authority and because of the war, said, we're going to make an issue of this. And of course, that's what we were, what we were doing. We were saying, by giving them the advance opportunity, saying, we do want you to. We invite you to take a position on the war.
Yeah, yeah.
And to maybe pray with us, maybe not arrest us. We invite you. And we, frankly, a lot of us, I think, were optimistic as we were going on without being arrested that they were going to let us.
It was very weird.
Yeah, it was. And I think they were a little conflicted. And I think we did well in the court when the one police officer we had to testify for us, that we didn't press him that hard, because I think he's still thinking about it. Yeah. And as I hope the judge is, so. We shall see.
Scott, thanks for your time.
No problem.
Thank you.